Welcome back for another episode of Subscription Radio. I'm your host, DJ Fish, aka Ben Fisher, aka co-founder of The Rodeo. And with me, I'm super excited to introduce you to Nathan Lomax. Nathan, I don't even know how we first connected. It was probably like 6 or 7 months ago, but Nathan runs Quickfire Digital, which is an agency started about 5.5 years ago that one of the top Shopify Plus agencies in, I'd say, in Europe. I know, I don't know if that's specifically to the UK, but your name came up over and over again when I was talking to people around agencies, and I know you've won some awards specifically for that within Shopify Plus. And, you know, I'd say beyond that, like I believe you started your first agency when you were like 18 years old. Isn't that right? So this is at this point, you're like, you're a serial agency entrepreneur.
I think that.
Although at 18, it probably wasn't Shopify.
No, it wasn't Shopify. And actually it was more of a freelance life, right? Like at the end of the day, I left school. Like the big focus, particularly in the UK, is that when you finish school, you go to university, and that's how they measure their kind of success. And for me, I didn't want to go to university, but no word of a lie, I think there was probably two people in our whole year that didn't go to university, and I had my place at Loughborough. I deferred it. I tried to set up the, I just said, you know what, I'm going to try and set up my own business, see how it goes. And the first year went better than expected, so I deferred for a second year just in case I had that safety net. And then the second year went even better, and I thought, blimey, I can't keep deferring this thing. So I took the plunge, decided not to go, got a mentor, and the rest is history. And now I grew that kind of as a freelance business until I was about 22, 23. And then I got to the point where I realized that I didn't think many people would want to work for NathanLomax.com. I just was like super vain. I was like, surely, yeah, it's not Calvin Klein, right? Like at the end of the day, I'm going to need a brand and everything else. And I also found that very honestly, like as soon as I took a holiday, there was no business. I would build, I would kind of sell stuff in the day and get it built during the night and wake up and check it, etc. And I built a team out in India, which 18, 19 was pretty cool. And I learned so much. But at the same time, I just thought, blimey, this isn't right in terms of me and where I want to be. And I always had that dream of walking into a massive open plan office with tens of people or hundreds of people. And little did I know the challenges that people would bring as much as I love it. But you know what? Like then 2017, first June 2017, we rebranded to Quickfire Digital. I met two other co-founders. I've always said that if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together, right? And I think that's a pretty famous quote. And so we found two co-founders that were instrumental in our growth in terms of Fred heading up e-commerce strategy or strategy originally and then latterly into e-commerce strategy, and Martin systems, process, finance, the stuff that I am useless at, filling out paperwork, documentation. That's not my bag. So kind of know your strengths and weaknesses, get others in to support you. And then the agency just went nuts, and obviously lockdown happened. And just before we came on air, I was talking about like, we were just about to niche, and I didn't know what sector we would niche in. And my parents have always had hotels. So I crazily thought, oh, we'll focus on hospitality. And then the alternative was e-commerce. And we'd had a few projects in e-commerce, and we loved doing work in e-commerce. And so we decided e-commerce and Shopify was going to be our focus. And sure enough, the pandemic hits, e-commerce goes ballistic, and hospitality falls on its knees. And it just massive slice of luck. And I think anyone that tells you they've grown a successful organization, I mean, we've got a long, long way to go for where I want to get it to. But I'm so grateful for where we've got it to, and we'd never be here without a massive slice of luck. So yeah, anyone that said, of course, it's hard work and skill and time and all that good stuff, but you've got to have some luck on the way as well.
Yeah, no, and I think, I mean, I'm curious if you had pivoted into hospitality, if you just would have moved right through and pivoted into e-commerce, right? You could still be possibly in the same position. You just been like, first step, not the right move. Now we're going to move. We're going to reposition into e-commerce.
I think so. I think we probably would have maybe got here, albeit a little bit later. I think the best thing we did is when we started to focus, and that's, I guess, a lesson for anyone, is that when you focus on something, everything becomes much clearer. So it was like, okay, well, the content I need to be putting out, the conversations I need to be having, the type of ideal client profile, everything becomes clear because we knew what we stood for and we kind of had our mark in the sand. Whereas previously, we were getting leads for all sorts of businesses, for all sorts of sectors, and we just didn't know what we were really good at and what we enjoyed. But as soon as we identified that, everything became easier, the work became more enjoyable, we bizarrely started getting better results. And actually then it's just kind of like a massive snowball. Everything's just compounded, right? We've had great conversations, great case studies, good opportunities, the awards we touched upon earlier. We just recently, we were nominated for the European Small Ecom Agency of the Year. So I was like, this is fantastic. What an opportunity for the agency. But I've always heard with awards, there's kind of a bit of a conspiracy around, oh, you only win those things if you buy a table, et cetera. And I was like, right, well, if we're going to kind of win this award, I'm going to have to buy a table. So we shell out on a table and we fly seven of the team to Barcelona and put them in hotels and flights and dinners and everything. Anyway, gets to the award. And I started about an hour before, I thought, imagine if we didn't win. How embarrassing would that be? Sure enough, it comes to us and they read out our name. We're like, "Wee!" And then it comes to the winner is, and it wasn't us. And I was just like, this is horrendous. This is so embarrassing. So the upshot is 2 weeks later, they were running the big e-com awards. So no longer Small Ecom Agency of the Year, just E-commerce Agency of the Year across Europe. And I was still like a little spoiled child. I said, I'm not buying a ticket. What a fraud. I'm not even going to attend. So I didn't go and none of our team went. And then they sent an email to say, huge congratulations on the win last night. Where do you want us to send the trophy? And I was like, are you joking? I'm at home and I've not gone. I'm just such an idiot. So yeah, it's kind of like lesson learned, right? You just got to lick your wounds and go again. And who knows what opportunity is around the corner. And it was a huge accolade for the agency and a great testament to all the hard work that's been put in last 4 or 5 years.
Well, and you've at least debunked the conspiracy in at least one or two shows.
Absolutely.
Right? I guess what we can do is you debunked it within two shows. But that is funny. Oh, man. And so you talk a little bit about the agency itself. Like, are you full service? Because I know, you're focused specifically on e-commerce, but I know you work with sportswear brands like Tala. I actually don't know how to pronounce that. No, it's T-A-L-A. Yeah, Tala. Is it Tala or
Tala? Tala is the founder, Grace Beverly, an incredibly inspirational lady that's done some great things in the world of entrepreneurship. And we're incredibly fortunate to be working with those guys and girls. We have some amazing clients: Snug Sofa, Juicy Couture, Fila, High Tech.
Yeah,
we're hugely proud of the brands that we're working for, and we're just it's funny, I've been told we've won another one. They've not signed the contract, and so I'm thinking, depending on when this comes out, like, I can't say it and then suddenly we've got it or not got it. But look on my LinkedIn and hopefully you'll see a big brand dropping. We just won Clarendon Fine Art, Mookie Toys. Like, we've got some cracking brands. I'm so humbled to see the kind of clients, that the profile of the clients shifting as we scale. But yeah, the agency, another reason for our growth, I believe, is the fact that we've not only focused on sector, but on service offering. So more often than not, if you imagine a kind of an X and Y axis, many people would say, okay, we're just going to choose the sector, but we're going to go full service, or we're just going to choose the service, e.g. web development, but we're going to do it across the range, or SEO across all sectors. But what we did is said, no, we're going to choose e-commerce and we're going to choose Shopify, design and build, and a bit of conversion rate optimization, but pretty niched in terms of the service offering, pretty niched in terms of this sector, and then kind of draw them up, and there's our sweet spot, right? And that's essentially where we are. So we now know, okay, of the however many hundreds of thousands of brands on Shopify in the UK, this is our sweet spot in terms of retainers, in terms of projects, however many brands they've got on VisualSoft, on Magento, on any of the competing platforms. Like, essentially, it's our objective to get them onto Shopify or Shopify Plus. I think as the agency's grown, we then got an opportunity to become a Shopify Plus partner. There's one of 28 Shopify Plus agencies there's 28 Shopify agencies in the UK. We're one of those 28. And so again, that was just another kite mark or badge of honor, if you like, to say, actually, we are on the right path and we're doing the right thing. And that just gives the brand the social proof to know, actually, these guys can walk the walk as well, right? We're out there an awful lot. We're attending a lot of events. I mean, our events calendar last year, I think we ran about 50 events over the course of the year, with lunches, dinners, breakfasts, Total Wipeout, Crystal Maze, you name it. There were some wacky events that went on. This year, the plan is to do all that again, bring more retailers to the table, panel events, retailer parties, all sorts. But the main focus is just getting good quality merchants in a room together to network and learn from each other. And that is our focus for 2023, is how can we double down on the right type of merchant and build this e-commerce community that we're trying to create.
And is this predominantly in, like, I'll say the UK, but like in London specifically, like, and is that where a lot of these brands are? Yeah.
It's interesting. Essentially, we do a lot of stuff in London purely really for convenience, in terms of it's easy enough for us to get to 2.5 hours into London, and it's where a lot of brands are. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we've got some big opportunities in the Middle East currently, and it's an opportunity I'm actively exploring with some boots on the ground and a few other partnerships out there. The US is also a massive market we would love to break into and do some more stuff in. We've got a couple of clients out there, and we're getting a couple of more intros out there, but I do think there's a big opportunity there that we are not yet servicing. It's incredibly saturated with agencies in terms of quality of agency. That's up for debate, but there's certainly a lot of agencies out there. Mm-hmm. And so it's just finding where you fit. And I've always believed in this kind of plus equals minus model, where actually a lot of our leads come from agency partners, right? And tech partners. And therefore, mm-hmm. it's just understanding where you sit. And if suddenly you're spreading yourself into the Middle East and into the US, and therefore are you losing a bit of kind of market control in the UK? And do you take your eye off the mm-hmm. ball, and suddenly you become something for everyone and not anything for any single person? I think we've got to avoid like stretching ourselves too thin and overscaling.
I guess that'd be the Z axis. You have your X, you have
yeah.
your Y, and then that.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe there's a Z going across the top, which yeah. is kind of all the different countries and where we've got to focus our time. And the speed of growth, I probably think, is on the Z axis, right? Which is essentially is mm-hmm. where do we want to grow and how quickly do we want to grow? And the agency mantra this year is all around less is more. We don't need 300 Shopify migrations to have a successful agency. We don't need mm-hmm. 6,000, well, we call them retainers, but subscriptions. We don't need 6,000 a year to be mm-hmm. successful, right? We need probably 40 at any one time, and mm-hmm. we need 40 retainers at any one time, and probably 5 or 6 projects at any one time to have a successful agency. And that means the environment here, we're able to get the right environment with people being able to learn, develop, improve, but at the same time, they're not being burnt out as well. And that for us is really important. It's not just a case of growth at all mm-hmm. costs. It's about sustainable mm-hmm. growth, so that in 5, 10, 15 years, we're still here to tell the story and hopefully flying the flag for Shopify on a global scale, as opposed to just here across Europe.
Got it. I'm curious, but it's funny when you were talking about like niching down, because I would say even the three that you mentioned, which was, we'll call it design and development, I'll say those are two things, and then CRO.
Yep.
You know, like there are just like agencies that just do conversion rate optimization, right? So you're still interestingly like doing a trifecta of things. But I also know agencies that only do development, they don't do any design, and vice versa. Yeah. And so I'm curious how much, like if you were to like, of the work you're doing, do you typically do all three of those for like 95% of your projects, or does it skew more towards one or the other, or
yeah,
one of the three?
Question. I think to start with, I mean, design is kind of built in with build. We never just do design and not build. Mm-hmm. It's always design right. and build, or conversion rate, or
sense.
Just build and conversion rate stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, the conversion rate stuff focuses on 4 key metrics, right? New sessions, average order value, repeat purchase, and conversion mm-hmm. rate. If we can focus on mm-hmm. those 3 things or 4 things, then fantastic, we can scale any e-commerce store. I think the challenge comes that if you'd asked me this 18 months ago, I'd say that we were probably 70% projects, 30% retainer. We're trying to mm-hmm. pivot that whole thing to be 70 to 80% retainer and 20, 30% projects, right? So actually, we're going through a huge shift at the moment. Whereas if you ask me exactly today, yeah, if you ask me exactly today, we're around 45, 55 in terms of just over mm-hmm. on projects ever so slightly. But actually, ask me this, honestly, the next month or 2 months should be the tipping point where we flip, where we mm-hmm. say, okay, each month we need to do X amount of revenue in projects. And I'm very meticulous about the 7 pillars. And the 7 pillars of our agency are, I'm going to literally put myself on the spot now, but we've got design and build, we've got retainers, we've got IT, which is kind of Shopify POS installations, we've got ad hoc, people just wanting odd changes, we've got training, we've got consultancy, and we've got sponsorship. And they're the 7 kind of pillars of revenue for the agency. And so the sponsorship allows us to put on the amazing events we put on. The Shopify mm-hmm. POS installations allow us to do more around omnichannel. And there's a huge growth in omnichannel of the last 12 to 18 months. And I think we'll see that going forward, certainly throughout this year and into next. I think the retainer side of the business is really the one that needs to be flying the flag. And we have very set goals in terms of what retainer revenue needs to look like this month and next month and the month mm-hmm. after and the month after and at the end of the year. And I think the scary thing is that as long as you nail all the projects should go onto retainers. And we started selling retainers now at the project stage. So the projects are almost mm-hmm. a means to get someone onto a retainer as opposed to them just yeah. going for retainer at the back. Like you need the project to then have the stable platform to then work through the list of recommendations and 90-day plans to say, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to scale the store, etc. So yeah, I envisage the agency doing 4 or 5 projects a quarter and then doing most of the work through retainers going forwards.
And is most of your work with brands at the point where they're migrating to Shopify? And how many of them are like brand new stores that are like, we have an idea, we have a product, we're going to sell, versus established, we'll say established brands that are migrating over?
For sure. So certainly the build side, a lot of it is migrations. Probably 90% of the build side is migrations from another platform, typically VisualSoft or something like that. In terms of the retainers, a lot of them are already on Shopify, either by us or by other agency, but they're all on Shopify. We wouldn't touch a retainer in another platform. I think, just remind me, Ben, of the second question.
Yeah, it was basically what the starting point is for the relationships.
That was it. So the size of the size of the client, right? Like essentially our minimum price point is, well, it's now 20 to 50K. That's kind of edging up ever so slightly, probably closer towards 30 to 50K. And therefore, very rarely do we get a startup. You sometimes get a well-funded brand. What I think what we've learned is that the more we do, the more we understand our ideal customer profile, which is so, so important, or ICP kind of persona, however you want to badge it up. And I think they need to be doing roughly $1 million in revenue to justify the investment in retainer.
Right.
So if they're not doing $1 million in revenue, it's sometimes very difficult. Now, there are edge cases and occasions where actually we can do stuff a bit smaller and the brand is the right brand, et cetera, on a scale-up journey and or being funded or whatever. But yeah, 9 times out of 10, the brand will be doing at least $1 million in revenue, will be on the Shopify platform, and will have the appetite and ambition to scale. And that's the big thing as well, is that even just because you're doing the revenue, you still have to have the appetite and the mindset. If you don't have the appetite and mindset to want to scale something, it is pointless. Yeah, they need to come on the journey and have that growth kind of angle where they're like, you know what, every month we want to obsess about marginal gains and we want to see how conversion rate is just turning the needle ever so slightly. And what about repeat purchases? Can we just edge those up ever so slightly? And a lot of that is introducing subscription programs and loyalty schemes and things like that. And then you think about, okay, repeat purchase, what are we doing around email marketing flows and how can we encourage that? Average order values, what are we doing around upsell on checkout and all that good stuff? And then finding new sessions, kind of while we don't drive the traffic, what are we doing in terms of net new sessions? How are we making sure that when people come to the site, that they're getting the best possible experience they can? And how are we dovetailing with an SEO agency or a PPC agency or a paid social agency to drive the right quality of traffic to the website?
Yeah, and that's interesting because you just touched on actually a bunch of things that'd be interesting to talk about. One of which is how much of this do the brands do in-house, right? Like, do they do their own email marketing? Do they have like a director of growth or director of e-commerce who's, you know, owning aspects of, I mean, obviously owning maybe like paid acquisition? So are there situations where you guys come in and you're helping consult on certain pieces of their business, but some pieces they're owning in-house?
Definitely. There's 90% of the brands we work with have an e-com manager, e-com director, head of growth, something like that. Normally an e-commerce team. And then we're essentially becoming an extension of their team. Right. There are occasional brands, I was speaking to one just this morning, that's just gone into new e-com role. She's the one person in the e-com team. And therefore, she's much more willing to say, Nathan, I need to lean on you and your team for the dev and conversion rate stuff. I'll then need to find someone for email. And the beauty is with the network and Black Book we've built, someone like that, I'm like, no problem at all. This is who you need to speak to for email. This is who you need for SEO. Tell me a price point, and I've got different tiers. And in my head, I know if you want to spend $1,000 a month on SEO, I know where to send you. If you want to spend $5,000 a month on SEO, I know where to send you. If you want to spend $1,000 a month on email, I know where to send you. $5,000 I can send you. PPC the same, paid social the same, content the same, PR the same, all of the different tranches. So then I can just become that trusted advisor where it's not just a case of, can you help us with our dev? Yes, I can. And I'll sell in our team and then I'll hand it over to our team. But actually, while I've got you, Nath, how can you help me with email or with SEO? We can't. But rather than me marking it up and telling you I'm doing it, I'm not doing it, here's a direct introduction, right? Here is this person's email address. Here is a warm intro. Have a conversation. I'm happy to jump on calls. I'm happy to help you find the right agency or the partner. I'm happy to work with those people. But at the same time, I want to make sure we're not saying we do stuff that we don't do.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I'd say as you're going through and you mentioned sort of like the different areas that you are advising brands to double down on, whether it's call it post-purchase upsells, subscriptions, loyalty, like all the different categories. Since you guys are a dev shop, what is your decision-making process of like custom builds versus using products off the shelf when you're going through and thinking through what, you know, like, and how often are you doing a custom build versus using something that's off the shelf?
Certainly in terms of the app ecosystem within Shopify, 95% of it is off the shelf. So mm-hmm. we have built a connector, which allows us to extend the capabilities of Shopify. Mm-hmm. But that's typically in terms of the core platform itself. In terms of integrating a loyalty system, like unless there's a business case and budget and good reasoning to build a custom loyalty module, there are some amazing loyalty mm-hmm. providers out there, whether it's Loyalty Line, whether it's Yotpo, whether it's someone else like mm-hmm. Swell, et cetera, like that's handled and done very, very well. Therefore, to my mind, there's no business case unless a client tells me different to want to do custom. Mm-hmm. You then look at, okay, reviews, and you could use Yotpo or you could use Reviews.io or you could use something else. And actually, you're like, well, again, we don't need a custom reviews block because even FIFO, Trustpilot, mm-hmm. et cetera, they exist already. So we're reinventing the wheel. We're not adding value. Like we can install a widget, customize a widget, make sure it's in brand, look and feel. That's enough, nine mm-hmm. times out of 10. I think the big balance comes between filling the site full of apps, and that's where you need to have a sensible conversation. Right. I think the more times off the shelf versus not off the shelf, e.g. custom versus theme-based, is kind of when you're choosing the template, if you like. So for us, we'd like mm-hmm. to use maybe a boilerplate, something we've built within Quickfire that gives us a standing start, but is lightweight and allows us to scale the brand quickly, versus actually something off the shelf where the client pays $300 and they've got a look and feel, etc. I mean, we've moved away from that now. We do a bit of e-commerce training and I do a bit of mentoring with some startups. And I normally say to them, look, if you kind of got $3,000 or $4,000, you don't need to be going custom. It's crazy. Like just go with a theme. They're mm-hmm. absolutely fine to get you started. Build a proof of concept, build an MVP, come back to me and tell me that it's worked. And then I'll by all means suggest you build custom. But until that point, don't just chuck money after mm-hmm. custom. And I think that's a big thing for brands to watch out for is, if they're new to it or it's their first store, if they're not too sure, mm-hmm. then you don't need to spend all the money as soon as you got it. The amount of brands I work with that have gone through a raise and they're just like, well, I've got all this money now. We're going to go custom. I'm like, still, just because you've got the money, it doesn't mean you need to go custom. What's the business case? Oh, because we've got a theme and it's quite slow and we've got some limitations and we'd like to do X, Y, and Z. No problem at all. Let's go custom. Versus, oh, because that's what you've got to do when you're a big brand. No. That's absolutely not the case, right? The whole point is like mm-hmm. you might be absolutely fine on a theme, and some of the most successful e-commerce stores, some you wouldn't even know actually when you do some digging, are based off a theme. So what I would say on that is just custom has its time and place, but also so does off the shelf. And I think certainly for apps off the shelf, 99 times out of 100. And I mean, our typical client, 99 times out of 100 will be a custom-based design and build. But there is the odd mm-hmm. edge case where I say, you know what, a theme is absolutely fine for you.
Yeah. And how many of your builds are headless versus, and I know headless means different things to different people, but I think for all intents and purposes within Shopify, what we mean is a headless, just that, like the headless storefront.
Yeah, absolutely zero. We made a very conscious decision as an agency okay. that we don't have the skills to do headless. And we have a few partners mm-hmm. that are in the model of plus equals minus. And I talk about this on a lot of shows I go on. Plus means people and agencies further on the journey than you. Equals are agencies and people at the same stage as you, and minus are people earlier on than you. Not better or worse, just further on and mm-hmm. further back. Okay. And so mm-hmm. we have quite a few agencies further on the journey than us, doing more revenue, mm-hmm. employing more people with more profile that actually are far more capable with headless than we are. And so right. when they're sending me stuff for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, and I'm saying, thank you very much, and I really appreciate it, et cetera, I need an opportunity to send something back. And actually the chance mm-hmm. to build that reciprocity and send something back for us is headless. We don't have the skills in-house. Mm-hmm. We know great people that can do it. Why wouldn't we say, you know mm-hmm. what? These guys, have a chat with them, or these guys over here, or whatever it's going to be. It's really important that we don't try to do everything for everybody. And as much as headless excites me and where the future of e-commerce is going excites me, we're not ready for headless. And therefore, I would just simply say, not one for us. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I appreciate the thoughtfulness around that. I think, you know, going back into the leveraging of apps, as soon as you go headless, there's a lot of apps you can no longer leverage, right?
Yeah.
At least on the front end.
There's a lot of things that people don't see, right? Or consider when it comes to headless. It's like, it sounds really sexy. It sounds like the way to go, and oh, I'm a big brand, I must go headless. And you lose some of the kind of admin controls and the considerations and the need for kind of development expertise. And all of a sudden, you open up a couple of cans of worms that perhaps you didn't need to. So don't get me wrong, headless is absolutely right for some businesses and it can have amazing effects, mm-hmm. but it's not right for every business. Just because you're a big brand doesn't mean you need to go headless.
Yeah. Yeah. I know firsthand some brands that have gone headless and then gone back. And again, I think it very much depends on circumstances. Just as you were saying, whether or not to go a custom template versus off the shelf, it depends on your situation. And I think 9 times out of 10, the folks who go headless, the typical arguments I've heard are wanting more control over the, like we'll call it, the user experience or performance. And I think the performance piece, I mean, it's probably debatable because you can certainly, there are themes, there are lightweight themes and ways that you can build themes into Shopify that we might be talking about. Like, unless you're dealing with an enormous amount of traffic, it's going to have a very negligible or very incremental effect and less so than the costs incurred of having to maintain a headless infrastructure. Yeah, no, so that's interesting. And have you guys built any apps, I guess, beyond that connector that you referenced?
Yeah, we started to, we found kind of quirks with Shopify, frustrations that we thought, you know what, if we have this connector, then we can inject some apps mm-hmm. or APIs or integrations through the connector, and therefore it should have less impact on page load, etc. And we've seen some interesting mm-hmm. results with that. I think the IP around the connector and where we're looking to take that and what we'd like to do is a really exciting journey for the agency to go on. I think, as always, Ben, the challenge is just resource. Like, it's something that mm-hmm. the connector always gets worked on, but it gets worked on when the client needs something to be worked on. Very rarely do mm-hmm. we have bandwidth to just have days on end where you can just work on the connector to do the things you would like to do. And therefore, the connector grows at the pace that it grows, which is dictated by the client, not dictated by the mm-hmm. agency, which, of course, I'm incredibly grateful for, because I'd sooner be nice and busy than I would quiet. But at the same time, I do often mm-hmm. think, God, if I won the lottery and could inject some cash into it. I mean, everything's been done organically, right? And so it's like, mm-hmm. if someone just said, like, here's a couple hundred grand, I'd just say, okay, here's a whole crack team of developers, just go and finish the connector and do what I would like to do with it and where we would like to take it as an agency. But right now, the connector's getting some good traction and there's some nice features. And what's nice, of course, is that if you build something for somebody, you can often say, actually, that brand over there might need it. And you can start to look at kind of mm-hmm. cross-pollination, et cetera, which provides other interesting opportunities as well. And that's one thing I think we'll see more and more this year in the world of e-commerce is those collaborations. So I saw that Fila, one of our clients, and Fila and Tala, another one of our clients, had a collab mm-hmm. last year. And I think you'll see more and mm-hmm. more of this going into 2023 and beyond, is these brands coming together to collaborate, to split costs, split resources, come up with cool concepts. I'm really excited to see where that goes this year.
Yeah. And is that more around like co-marketing and bundling of products, or is that like, where are you seeing that happen?
Yeah. So a bit of it is around co-marketing, and we're seeing a lot of that, particularly in the agency and tech space. But in the retailer side, mm-hmm. There's less, a bit about co-marketing, but it's actually just around collab on actual product. That is maybe mm-hmm. One person manufacturing, another person branding it up, or they've come up with a design together, or whatever it's going to be, or mm-hmm. they're just testing different demographics. Like, I think it's up to retailers to just have a play and see what fits. And actually, if you've got a similar audience, or perhaps a different audience, but you've got a different way your product can be utilized, I think I'm really interested to see the creativity that comes from retailers where they say, I've got product A, for years it serviced this market. If we did this, this, and this, we suddenly have product B that could service a totally different market that we've not got into. How are we going to test or enter that market? Rather than spending hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands on marketing to create some kind of splash and brand awareness, why not just do a collab with someone that's already got some market penetration and see if we can leverage that? And if we can, then actually we build a business case to double down on that. If we can't, then we cut our losses and we go back to what we're doing very well. And I think collaborations give you a great opportunity to test new markets without necessarily having to invest hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Interesting. And I'm curious, and you might not have as much visibility into this, but how receptive, like, so for in the example you just gave of, let's say, you know, I'm trying to keep this concrete and give like examples. Let's say I sell I'm from Maine, so I'll say maple syrup. I'm a maple syrup company. I want to test a market around, we'll say, beauty cosmetics, right? Maple syrup on your face.
Yeah.
If I'm the maple syrup company and I'm approaching Kylie Jenner, right? What is the incentive or the pitch to Kylie around doing this collaboration? Like, is it the fact that there's like a revenue share? Because my assumption is effectively Kylie's going in and you might come up with this co-branded maple syrup for your face product. Kylie's testing it with her audience, testing it with her existing customer base. Yeah. Is that typically how you see these sort of collaborations happening? Or am I thinking about it slightly differently?
No, I think certainly a lot of them based on one of the sides having some kind of strong marketing arm or potential influencer or something. Like in your Kylie case, she's already got the reach, the traction, etc. Like, therefore the collab is very much kind of one way, and there's probably a rev share or something to incentivize her to do so. I think the collabs I like to see are where you can genuinely find win-wins for both parties. So actually, the maple syrup brand actually has, they've done some profiling and they've found that 90% of the people that buy maple syrup are women. And they're like, no way. And oh my God, what about if we did a maple syrup makeup? And actually all of a sudden, the maple syrup company can sell just as many units as Kylie can. And all of a sudden, then we have an interesting opportunity. So that to me is the collabs I really like, where both backs can be scratched. I'm however well aware that that cannot always be the case. And as long as there's equal involvement and kind of return on each side, then fantastic. The challenge where collabs fall down, and that's in agency land or retail land or wherever, is when one party is getting all the kind of good stuff and the other party is giving all the time and effort and energy for little return.
Yeah.
That's when you get a collab that doesn't work and ends up never kicking off.
Got it. That makes sense. And just to sort of shift gears a bit, since we are on subscription radio, I realize that we actually haven't talked really about subscriptions whatsoever. So I guess one question I have is, of the brands you work with, how many are subscription? Because I know you have everything from sportswear and apparel to sofas to, you know, the whole gamut.
For sure. I'd say around 15 to 20% are subscription brands. I'd say 50 to 60% have the opportunity to have subscription, maybe even more. And I think many are looking at subscription and for whatever reason, deciding when and where the time is for subscription to land. Subscriptions have many benefits. They also have many challenges. And I think that, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day with a brand and we were sitting down and saying, actually, an environmental impact should be seen as positive with subscriptions. You're kind of using the amount you need. And then when it's finished, you're buying more or kind of getting sent more. The challenge is if the cadence is wrong, then what you find is you've got 19 shaving foams and you only need one because you're still on the first one, and then you end up binning them and they go to landfill or whatever. So it's just about making sure that the subscription cadence and automations and sequences are smart enough to know, particularly around refillable products, there's no set rule that says every single person is going to finish my product within a month. If you're selling anything like a soap or a shower gel or whatever, some people use it quicker, some people use it slower. And therefore, that links into the kind of regular comms with a client to try and understand, but also making the repurchasing experience easy, right? And that's where, again, many of our clients are kind of struggling or thinking is like, actually, there's lots that goes into this. It's a sophisticated process. It's not like tomorrow I just, again, just one product which you can buy every single month or get sent every single month isn't a subscription business, right? It's just a product that you can buy multiple times. Like, it normally needs a catalog of products or an array of options. And so for me, I think there's more and more subscriptions to happen in 2023 with our brands. I was doing some research the other day. 70% of merchant, 70% of customers said they'd be prepared to receive a subscription this year. So the market's still ripe for it. It's just about the convenience and making sure it's the right subscription. And we're living in this kind of conscious world now as we go into potential recession, etc., where people are going to be penny pinching, and waste is important. Waste from a financial point of view, but waste also from an environmental point of view. And therefore, if we can get the cadence right and the price point right, and people can budget using subscriptions, fantastic. But if you start getting waste and overage and excess, etc., you can be sure that churn will go through the roof as people consider those two factors and think, actually, you know what? I could do without this. I could just go to the shop and buy this as and when I need it. I've lost the benefits of subscription, the convenience, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I mean, that, I think that is the number one reason people cancel a subscription is too much product, right? And I think that's the inherent challenge with the subscription model or even subscriptions in general. It's where the point in which the subscription is no longer convenient. And people subscribe for a multitude of reasons. Sometimes it's curation. Sometimes it's, you know, access to higher quality products than they could get through like Amazon. Like one of the brands we work with, Jot, there's certain products you can only get as a subscriber, right? So they really framed it as around membership, where as a member,
exclusivity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's bang on, Ben. That's where I think you should go. Yeah. That's where more brands should go. Rather than just eroding margin and, oh, you can save a fiver by subscribing.
Yeah.
How about you unlock exclusive features or get access to events or form a community or a tribe, or all of a sudden the subscription has so much value, but you're not just knocking off price.
Yeah. No, and I think because as soon as you start getting into just you're saving money, it becomes, you commoditize the value. And I think as more and more brands are offering subscriptions, I describe it almost like you have your primary subscription, secondaries and like tertiary subscriptions. Like the primary is a thing that you're going to get every single month or on some sort of very regular basis. But because these products are physical, like they're fairly high price point. I think the latest stat I saw was the average American household has like a $250 budget for subscriptions. And so if you take $250, divide that by like average order value of, let's say, let's make it easy. Let's say it's $50, right? That means that you can buy five products on subscription for an entire household. And so people are going to be increasingly selective as more and more brands offer subscriptions of, well, which subscriptions do I actually need? And I think what you hit on was, well, if I can't predict how often I need this, then I'm either going to be super wary of subscribing in the first place, or I'm going to be the first one to cancel when I'm like, shit, I don't need more of this. This is taking up room in my apartment and I feel like I'm wasting money.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's what you hit on is, I'd say one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about, both for myself as a consumer, as well as just in speaking with brands and the way that we think about the problem space and the opportunity. I know one thing you were joking about before the call was you're going through and thinking through what subscriptions do you have. And I thought one thing that I really appreciated is you're like, we have subscriptions of things that we don't even realize are subscriptions, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know, you want to go through your bulleted list of like, what subscriptions do you have?
I was putting together some thoughts before I jumped on. I was like, actually, like my phone bill comes out every month, our water bill, like loads of our utilities, a rent or a mortgage. And okay, they have an end date in mind, but I get my car, like so much of my life is pay as you kind of pay monthly for things. I mean, people are now putting sofas on finance and they're putting fridges on finance and they're like subscribing to things. And then in 2 years they get a new one. And I'm like, that's the way the world is going. I'm so used to playing in increments and chunks rather than big lump sums. My other half's mom is looking at a new car and she's talking about buying it out. I can't fathom the thought of dropping like 20 grand on a car. That just baffles me. Why wouldn't you just pay it off monthly like everybody else, like most other people? Not everyone, sure, but most people. And I just think the whole shift in society has become to pay things monthly, and therefore subscriptions tapping into that psyche. I think, like you say, the big thing is just around relevance, and also the fact that there's multiple places to log in, to remember, to cancel, to swap. I mean, one of the features I love about subscriptions is swapping or gifting. And that's something I remember when I was working with a flower brand and we were looking at brands like Freddie's Flowers, who I think do this really nicely. And you're like, actually, each month, rather than you get like, there's only so many fresh flowers you can have in the house. I'm sure my other half would disagree, but like, essentially, how about every other month you decide to gift it to someone? So you send some to your family or you send some to friends or someone that's helped you or whatever. And that I really like, the idea of actually each month having the opportunity, as long as I'm reminded on email, because the amount of times I'm like, I had a beer 52 subscription. I love my kind of guest ales and stuff like that. And I was finding every month I was drinking four or five. And then I was saying, right, I'm not going to drink this week and I'm going to be really good. And then all of a sudden another box is coming. I'm thinking, crumbs, I haven't got space in the fridge. So then I moved it to 2 months. The challenge is now is that we've then had Christmas and whatever. And before I know it, I'm actually out of ales. And I'm thinking, when's the next one? But I haven't got the time or energy to log in. Right. I literally can't be bothered to log in. So I just have to wait. But I think the big one for me is Sky TV. And for anyone here that's got Sky TV, the biggest frustration is that as a new person, you get a better price than if you're a regular subscribing customer. That sucks. That is absolutely woeful. Why, if I've spent money for all these years and I've subscribed to a product consistently, paid on time, been a good customer, barely spoke to them, actually, Joe Bloggs comes in off the street, never spoke to them, but gets a third of the price. How does that work? But at the same time, I sit here and moan about it. But at the same time, to cancel it is an absolute nightmare. I have to call up. I have to sit in a queue. I have to wait probably an hour and a half of my day. Before I know it, I think, actually, I'll do that tomorrow. Tomorrow comes, I book up, I don't do it. And actually, I'm then charged the next subscription amount anyway. And if it wasn't for like the sport that I can get, I just literally would cancel the whole thing. But my life was so much better when I watched football and I watched my favorite team and everything else. And I'm just like, it's worth it just for that. But God, it infuriates me. Why should you lose paying a subscription? Surely you should lose joining, not paying a subscription. It's stupid.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've heard that several times of around like, why as a new customer am I, why are the new customers the ones being incentivized as opposed to rewarding loyalty, right? Which, you know, I think hits on, you know, the ways that some loyalty programs can be really powerful or not. But I think what you're also talking about is, and I'm trying to think of brands who do this, but I've certainly seen them where if the price drops, they drop it for their existing customers too, like the price of the product. I've never seen that with any, I can't think of any modern brand that I've worked with where they notified you, hey, congratulations, because we've reduced our prices.
Yeah.
We're going to automatically reduce yours. Typically, I mean, I think the closest thing I've seen is Slack, where they're like, they'll notify you if a member went inactive, like hasn't logged in, and they're like, we'll automatically not charge you for that customer or for that user. And I mean, it's weird. It's like from a purely psychological perspective, like I appreciate that because I'm like, I almost feel like they're looking out for me. Granted, whereas with Gmail, like I still have people who no longer work with us or we're consultants. I haven't wanted to deactivate their account because I don't know if there's something that we need potentially in the future to access it. So I'm still paying for their freaking Gmail account, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not getting value out of it. It's basically just an insurance policy at this point. Whereas I think the Slack approach I appreciate, where it's like, not only do you not have to monitor if someone's using their account, but well, basically we'll take care of it for you. And I think that in the subscription space, there's so many use cases around like your beer example of sometimes you need it sooner, sometimes you need it later, depending on your consumption habits. You know, just trying to think through like what could a brand possibly do to help make that a better experience, right? Like if they know the holidays are coming up, potentially it's them reaching out saying, hey, Nathan, I don't know if you're going to be, if you're doing a dry December or if you're going to go heavy. But just in case you are, we want to let you know that, yeah, no, if you order now, you'll get it ahead of like sort of the holidays, like the party season. I don't know.
But I mean, that's spot on, right? It comes back to customer service and comms, because I got 5 golden tickets to send to people to encourage them to drink beer in the month of January. Like 95% of the people I know are doing dry January. Therefore, it is totally, but if they give me that at Christmas, like, no problem. Right. Or even better still would be like November. They have the box in November. They love it. Christmas is then coming. They then think, blimey, I can actually get this for a gift. And all of a sudden, they've then won a new customer. But instead, they do it in January when no one wants it. And I'm just like, well, what am I going to do with these coupons? They're just pointless.
Yeah. It's so interesting how like just like thoughtfulness around the context of people's lives can make a difference. Like one idea that we have, maybe we'll still do it, was I want to manage subscriptions on my calendar. I want to see when the next subscription's coming up. And if I want it sooner, I just want to drag it to a different date, right? Like just on Google Calendar, right? Nice. Like that was, so we built a proof of concept of that, where it was like, if you live off of a calendar, it's like, because oftentimes you don't know when your next upcoming renewal is, right? Brands arguably don't necessarily like that idea because they kind of want you to be surprised, or they want you to not actively be seeing that you're paying for this thing.
Well, that's the only thing, Ben, of course, is that the deceitful side of this is that many subscriptions you forget about. And therefore, if it's in the calendar, it's more prominent. But from a user's point of view, how convenient to just be like,
right,
yeah, I want the subscription on Monday. I'm just going to drag it.
Well, exactly. Or if you could even change the address, right? Like, I don't want one more thing to worry about. I don't want to have to go, even the upcoming order reminders are great, but you still might go into spam. You might not see the text. You might not reply in time. Like, that's obviously much better than not notifying people at all. But ultimately, like, I want a simpler life. My adult life is unnecessarily complicated. I actively am trying to figure out ways to eliminate responsibility. And if you're subscribing to multiple things, it's like, for me, like, I live and organize my day by my calendar. And so I'd love to just be able to have a single place where I can manage all my subscriptions and like the subscription cadence. A lot of brands won't like that, but I think there's an argument, again, going from the consumer perspective, like, you know, if there's a way to accomplish it just for consumers, I don't think consumers would pay for that, but it'd certainly create value, right?
It'd be awesome. I'd be up for that.
Yeah.
Do it.
Hey, man, I know we've gone a few minutes over. I really appreciate you taking the time to jam on this. I was going to say, if people want to learn more about you or stay up to date on what you're working on, learn more about Quickfire Digital, you know, we'll put the link in the show notes, but what's the best place for people to connect with you personally or see? I don't think you're much of a Twitterer, but
I have a love hate relationship with Twitter. I think that, firstly, massive thank you for having me on today. I've loved chatting and talking through kind of life and the journey, etc. But in terms of keeping up with what we're up to and our plans, etc., I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. Just Nathan Lomax. Find me on there. Yeah, I post most days about what we're up to. I keep thinking about, do we go back to Twitter and get involved? For years, I was kind of active and then didn't. And now I consume most of my content through LinkedIn. But actually, I see Twitter's making a bit of a resurgence. So watch this space. Maybe I'll be back. We'll see.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. And one last question I like to ask is, do you have a big ask for everyone listening? Like, if there's one thing that could unlock like your business or be like extremely valuable to you as an individual, like, what's that one thing that you'd put out into the world saying, hey, if you could help me with this, I would be eternally grateful?
It's a great question. I've got, my big ask is that if you're a Shopify brand doing over $1 million in revenue and looking to scale your e-com store and find dev support, then please do reach out. Even if it's just a chat, I'd love to kind of have a conversation. The kind of unselfish thing is just be kinder to yourself and to others, right? And it sounds so cliche and crazy, but I started the 6-minute diary this year and just taking that moment to appreciate the day that's coming and the day that's gone has made a fundamental change to my life in the last 12 days. So if I can encourage anyone to do anything, if you haven't got the brand that's doing $1 million+ on Shopify, no stress, just get yourself a 6-minute diary, recognize the great day that you've had or the great day that's about to come. It will shift your perspective and it'll allow you to be kinder to people. No one goes to work to do a bad job, right? And people make mistakes. People are human. So just look after each other.
Yeah. It's actually funny. I have that same diary.
It's a good diary.
Someone gifted it to me. So that's something I've been doing every day and every night. Well, hey, man, I really appreciate it. And we'll put in the links in the show notes to you on LinkedIn and to the agency. This was fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much, mate. Take care. And thanks again.